welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. All three of our segments today have to do with people who are involved in improving the world and creating social change, but each of them goes about it in a very different way. In the second half of the show, we'll be joined by Amanda Pettifish Schrag, an assistant professor of theater at ISU, and a puppeteer. She'll be telling us about her work with puppets, which also involves raising people's awareness of social issues. We'll also hear from Pat Carney, a teacher from Iowa, who has taken to blogging to advocate for public education and encourage other teachers to speak out about education. His blogs have been picked up by the Washington Post and the Huffington Post, so we'll be talking with him about that. These are just samples of the thought-provoking and informative stories and interviews that we do on Local Talk and other shows in the KHOI lineup. So we want to remind you that these are the kinds of stories that you, the listener, have told us you enjoy and value. And now is the time to show us how much you value KHOI and the shows we bring you. It's our spring fund drive when we ask you to make a donation or become a member. A basic membership is $55 a year, and our goal is 25 new members. You can donate online at khoifm.org or on the phone at 515-292-2878, or drop by the station and become a member or make a donation in person. We really like that because when you stop by, we get to see who our listeners are. And remember, you can use check, credit card, or good old cash. There are many valuable resources in the Ames community that should be sustained, and KHOI is certainly one of them. And that's what our fund drive is all about. So think about what Ames would be like without KHOI and become a member to keep it going. Continuing on this theme of sustainability, it's time to also think about Earth Month and Earth Day coming up. And Mary Rankin is here with us, the Director of Sustainability for Iowa State University and also Sustainability Coordinator for the City of Ames. And she's brought a guest with her to talk about a wonderful resource that we have right here in our community that allows us to transport ourselves to places and experiences without ever leaving our Ames community or sometimes without even leaving the building.
That's right.
So thanks for being here, Mary, for your monthly visit. And I'm going to let you introduce the guest that you brought with you.
Thank you very much. Well, it's always a pleasure, and happy Earth Month to everyone.
Yeah.
It's very exciting. Well, I tell you, when I was thinking about who to bring this month, and as you mentioned, all the wonderful amenities that we have in our community that allows us to be resilient and involved and engaged and to think about that sustainable community that we all collectively want to leave for all of us now and for all those that follow us, I certainly thought of a wonderful resource that we have here in our community, and that's the Ames Public Library. And I brought with me today Lynn Carey, who is the director of the library. And I thought it was particularly applicable during Earth Month because, as you mentioned, we have the ability to go so many different places and experience so many different things, which is so important to looking at a sustainable community and feeling like we're engaged and connected to a sustainable community. And the library allows us to do that. And I have so many great memories as a child of going to my local library and my school library and just having all these different experiences and yet not leaving, you know, a single mm-hmm. place. And I think that was such an important part of what has led me to want to give back to my community in the profession that I'm in and wanting to be involved in supporting different amenities in my community. Certainly as it's Pledge Week here, one of the things that comes to mind, as well as the library, public radio, and all the wonderful things that we have available to us. So anyway, with that in mind, Lynn is here with me today, and I'm so excited to be able to share the wisdom that she has in her perspective related to sustainability.
Yeah, thanks for coming in, Lynn. It's good to see you today. And we're neighbors right down the street from each other, library and KHOI.
Yes, right in the cultural corridor of Ames.
That's right, one block away. So that's a really fun connection that, that Mary brings up, to think of our library as a place to provide adventures to us from anywhere and everywhere. Even if we can't necessarily get outside into nature, we can still experience and learn about that through the library.
Right. Nature as well as cultural diversity and, oh gosh, all the many, many things that make us so great and strong as a community.
What connections do you feel the library makes with our community?
Oh, there are so many. First of all, though, I'd like to wish each of you Happy Earth Month.
Thank you.
I don't know if you know this, but embedded in Earth Month is National Library Week.
And oh, that's
perfect.
Fabulous.
Yes. So this is coming to the end of National Library Week, but a very apt time to celebrate the sustainable features of a library in its community and certainly in ours. Our mission at the Ames Public Library is a very simple statement. We connect you to the world of ideas. And that's what we try to do every day through information, entertainment, and opportunity for community engagement. And it's not just in the building. We also have a lot of outreach programs. We have a bookmobile that goes all around the town. And then we have a 24/7 virtual presence as well with lots of resources available. So I could go on all day about all the ways that the library helps with making this a wonderful community. And it all circles back, though, to the investment that the community makes in the library. And at Ames Public Library, we're so fortunate to have a strong city management and to have an incredible community that supports us very well through their taxes, but also through involvement, through our volunteer program, and suggestions, ideas. We're just really lucky that way in Ames.
I've only lived here not even 3 years, but it didn't take me long to realize what a valuable resource the library is for everyone in the community. And, of course, the true value of resources is dependent on how they are managed and who is managing them.
Yes, exactly. And so with that in mind, Lynn, you being the manager of the library, the director of the library, how do you see your role specifically connected to ensuring the sustainability of this important community amenity?
I believe that any director or manager's main role is to provide the resources that the staff has available to serve the public. And so that's my main role, is finding resources, connecting to others in the community that want to invest in the library, and then hiring a really fantastic staff and letting them loose to do what they do best.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in Ames, we're incredibly blessed to have a truly committed bunch of people that work at the library in paid roles and unpaid roles as volunteers. So gathering those resources and then letting people do what they want to do.
That's fabulous. And I know you had mentioned you have a new strategic planning, of course, is an important piece of this. And you had mentioned that you have some really interesting components of strategic planning in the works. Do you want to talk briefly about that?
Sure.
Because I think the direction that, you know, all these resources move, of course, is vital.
Yes. And libraries, as you can imagine, attract very organized, thoughtful staff members. And so we're very much into planning. We spent about a year and a half gathering information from the public, from our staff, because they, of course, hear what everybody is most interested in. They keep on top of trends in the nation and the world in terms of library service. We also brought in a library futures expert to work with our two boards, our library board and our Friends Foundation board. And then we did a big community survey. And our manager's team sequestered in a room and went through all of these many, many pieces of data and landed them either in our strategic plan or in a companion document of management initiatives. And so we've ended up with three phases, and we're in phase one right now. We are working on what we have identified as strategic priorities, and those are to serve as a center for information access, to be the hub of community connections, to be the heart and discovery of creativity, and to be a place for literacy and lifelong learning. To that end, we've identified 10 initiatives, and I won't go through them all right now, but they are things like strengthening our relationship with the ISU community, mm-hmm. and we're doing that in myriad ways. So, by example, we're working directly with the Parks Library. It seems like a no-brainer, but it's something that doesn't happen in every community. And so we now have a bookmobile stop
right outside the
Parks Library.
It's great this year.
And we've started an internship program. Over the last year, we've worked with 18 energetic, bright experts in their field to enhance our services and programs. So those are just a few examples.
That's great. No, I think obviously it would be good to visit the library and learn more about strategic planning, because you guys really went through a very thorough process, and it sounds like a great vision that will take our community to the next level. That's great.
And Lynn, I notice you're reading from a brochure when you mentioned all these points from the strategic plan. Is that something that's available to people at the library?
It is right now.
Or information on the strategic plan?
Yes, yes. You can visit our website.
Okay. Just so people can be informed of all that. That's
really great.
On.
And how they can get involved, as you
yes,
mentioned.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And the library has an interesting history. Again, as I said, I haven't lived here long, but I understand that it has an interesting history that this vision kind of comes from. Is there anything else you can tell us about the kind of adventures the library has had through the years?
Well, we actually started in 1904 after having a group of strong women who gathered their own personal books and moved them from place to place around Main Street, and then decided we should have a building. And they convinced the then mayor to apply for a grant to the Carnegie Foundation, and they set to work to raise money to match that grant. Part of that was a bond referendum, and they actually convinced the powers that be at the time to allow women to vote in that bond referendum.
Wow,
so
really?
For one day, women enjoyed suffrage privileges.
That's impressive.
Yes. And I just think it's so funny. In the Ames Intelligencer, which was the paper of the day, it was reported after that bond referendum that fewer spoiled ballots were cast by women than by men. But then, of course, the very next day, they no longer had the right to vote.
Oh, my goodness.
But they had a library.
Right.
And so that was kind of the beginning. And then we've gone through multiple incarnations of different building projects through the years. Most recently, of course, in 2014, we opened with a vastly expanded building. And the building is an important part of what a library can do and be in a community. We were very, very thoughtful in the design of this building in terms of safety, security, and certainly sustainability. Mm-hmm. And we built at that point, we were working very hard to build to a LEED Silver standard. And we were quite fortunate then to find out that we had actually achieved LEED Gold.
That's so exciting.
Yes. And so we continue to look for green solutions. We continue to look at sustainability in terms of our collections, certainly in terms of our staff. So it's a theme that has run through, I think, probably from the very first ideas that these women who were hauling books around Main Street to mm-hmm. current days, that we want to have a really vibrant, vital resource for the community, and we are constantly looking and planning how we can sustain that.
I think that's so exciting, the facets of sustainability that come out so strongly, the environmental sustainability, certainly the economic sustainability, and the social sustainability in not only engaging and empowering, but I also think just the way that the library offers spaces, not only for individual sort of journeys and discoveries, but that almost non-expected opportunity for connection to different community members and to have those spaces to have discussions and interact and those sorts of things. So I think that's also an extremely thoughtful manner that the library has been put together in.
Well, we certainly did put a lot of thought into it and a lot of planning, and we've just been thrilled with the results. We have such a diversity of activity, not just what we're planning as a mm-hmm. library staff, but what happens in the building because right. it's a community resource. And the first night that we were open for business in the new building and had all of the meeting rooms booked, we had in one room there was a Boy Scout troop meeting. In another room, there was a Department of Human Services child abuse training session mm-hmm. happening. In another room, there were veterans meeting. Mm-hmm. And then in the fourth room upstairs, there was a manga dance troupe.
Oh, that's great.
So I think that's just a snapshot of the diversity nice. Of use by the community at the library. And then we plan just an amazing array of programs that we work with community groups mm-hmm. to plan. And really, I would urge people to check our newsletter at www.amespubliclibrary.org. We can also send it to you if you sign up mm-hmm. via email. And just every month, I'm astounded by what our staff has been able to pull together by working with partners throughout the community and have on offer for everyone else.
Yeah, it's such a rich diversity. So many wonderful things. And then there's just the, you know, coincidental, you see a neighbor, you see people looking at a book, you see, you know, the area for kids to interact is just incredible. So all sorts of new friendships and connections can be made.
Yes, we are so excited to see that happening on a daily basis.
Yes.
It's very exciting. And you'll notice when I talked about our strategic priorities, the word book didn't appear.
Yes,
I mean,
yeah.
certainly we are going to sustain our collection, and certainly that's a great resource to have a print collection. But that traditional idea of a library being a warehouse of books is, that's your grandfather's Chevrolet.
That's, you know, that's an interesting way of putting it, yes.
Not what we're all about. And it's fun to see how libraries are evolving and changing as their community needs change and as the world changes.
Right.
And I've heard that the library has recently received some honor and recognition for a particular adventure that you were engaged in. Can you tell us about that?
We have, in fact, two recent awards that are extremely meaningful to us. The first one was from the Penguin Random House Foundation. Of course, Penguin Random House is one of the largest publishers in the world. And they decided to have a new grant, and we are so thrilled that we will always be the first winners of this grant. And it was to recognize a library for its programming. And we submitted for a program that we do that's a parent education program that will result in smarter, happier babies who will thrive through life because they've gotten a good start. And so the award recognizes the nation's most innovative public libraries and librarians for community-based library programs that engage citizens in libraries. And that's what we're all about.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very exciting. It also included a $10,000 award. So
congratulations.
That's even more exciting. And then it's wonderful always to receive national attention, but most meaningful to us is when we are recognized within our own community. Mm-hmm. And so we were just beyond happy to receive the President's Award from the local NAACP chapter. And that, too, was in recognition not just of one thing that we've done, but over the last 5 or 6 years, we were recognized with appreciation for culturally relevant community building work that is benefiting the citizens of the Ames community and the surrounding area. And again, that's what we're all about. And it's just so meaningful to have our own community members see that we are providing that kind of resource.
That is impressive. Congratulations.
Thank you. And it all goes to our staff and our boards for being able able and willing to kind of break the mold a little bit.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's such a testament to all the great commitment and dedication. So, congratulations.
Thank you.
Do you want to tell us about things that are coming up, maybe connecting with Earth Day or anything else that you have going on that we should know about?
Yes. Mary's going to help me because I picked up the wrong piece of paper when I walked out last night. So we do have something planned.
Right. On Sunday the 23rd. So it is an Earth Day celebration. There are so many things going on, oh my goodness, in our community related to Earth Month and Earth Day and Earth Week. But the library is holding a wonderful celebration on the 23rd, and that's in conjunction with the Iowa State University Environmental Education Club. And they're doing that from 2:30 to 3. That will be the specific event. But then, of course, the library is open with all sorts of wonderful resources besides that. But I would also say just in general, to encourage our listeners on our website, on the Live Green website at Iowa State, which is livegreen.iastate.edu, we have a link to an Earth Month calendar. And my interns have put together sustainability-related events happening during the entirety of Earth Month. We have something like 14 pages of different items that either support environmental, economic, or social sustainability, a number of things helping to build and strengthen and connect our community. So I really encourage people to get out and look at that. And we have listed a number of the library things on there as well.
So we'll put the link for that with the information on today's show. So those links will be on our website.
That would be great.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us, Lynn. It's really great to have you here.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, wonder. It's a good connection we always try to make with the library. So we're glad to share the neighborhood with you. And Mary, thank you so much for coming in as well for your monthly segment. And we'll see you in a month.
Sounds great. Thank you. It's always my pleasure as well.
We've been talking with Mary Rankin, the Director of Sustainability at ISU and also with the City of Ames, and Lynn Carey, the Director of the Ames Public Library. Thanks again for being with us. There are so many Iowans committed to making and keeping Iowa a great place to live and to learn. Another person doing that is Pat Carney, the person we're going to hear from next. He's won numerous accolades and awards as a band teacher in Iowa. But recently, he's stepped into the public arena as a blogger, writing about the intersection of education and politics from the perspective of a teacher. Among other things, he's written a great deal about the current efforts in Iowa and elsewhere to increase the use of school vouchers and charter schools. And he's had several of those blogs receive national attention, and now his writings appear in the Huffington Post. I spoke with Pat Carney earlier this week, and I began by asking him to tell about his experiences as a teacher in Iowa.
I've taught for a little over 25 years, all in the state of Iowa. The last 16 years, I've taught in the Johnston Community Schools. Most of my career has been as a high school band director. And then in the last 2 years, I've served as the facilitator for the teacher leadership program here in the Johnston Schools, which means I support instructional coaches, model teachers, and other teacher leaders here in the Johnston Schools, providing them with professional development and just supporting our efforts in shared leadership here in our district, and have really developed a passion for the voice of teachers within our district and beyond our district in terms of being at the table when decisions are being made. And I think that Iowa is at the forefront of some teacher leadership initiatives, with every school in the state receiving some state grant money to provide positions and support learning around developing teacher leaders. And so I've become very passionate about that, and I think it's an initiative that is going to support good educational decisions in our districts, because the teachers who are in the classroom are playing a larger role in making some decisions at the district level.
And recently you've started a blog where you've been writing about education issues, and you've taken on some national issues and kind of written about how they're connected to Iowa.
You know, I started blogging about, it's been over 2 years, probably 2.5 years ago, and it very much started as a personal opportunity just to reflect. I point out to people that my initial blogs were read by maybe 15 people at a maximum. Around 2 years ago, I wrote a blog, again, just on my personal site, discussing education funding. It was a letter to Governor Branstad. If you go back in April of 2015, I wrote a letter that became fairly widespread and read across the state. And that was kind of the first foray into sort of political conversation. And then within the last year, on the same format, the same blog, I sent a note to our senator, Senator Grassley, asking him to not vote to confirm Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. That was followed by a blog or a letter to Betsy DeVos herself. And those got picked up pretty widely. The letter to Grassley and to Ms. DeVos ended up in the Washington Post, ended up and eventually led to me becoming a contributor for the Huffington Post, which I do semi-weekly columns and writing for them. And I did it because I think traditionally teachers don't feel the need to be political. I think that teachers frequently accept the status quo of what we're presented from the from our legislators. And I think here in Iowa, particularly in the last 2 years and maybe 3 or 4 years, it's become urgent that teachers advocate for our profession and not only for our profession, but advocate for our schools and for our kids. If we're not going to do that, if we're not willing to lend our voices to that, I think that it's unlikely that others will or certainly won't have the expertise that we can bring to the table of those conversations. So I felt the need to become an active voice for teachers and to encourage a lot of what I'm hoping to do is encourage other teachers to also lend their voices to these issues that are really, really important to providing the best possible public schools for all of our kids.
And you mentioned that one of your blogs was a letter to Senator Grassley, another to Betsy DeVos. But first, sure. I'd like to ask, what's been the reaction locally? I know it has gotten attention. You mentioned Washington Post and Huffington Post. But what's been the reaction you've gotten locally from this kind of a new role that you're proposing for teachers?
You know, the greatest response locally has been from my peers. I get a lot of response from, and interestingly, from very young teachers new to the profession and from veteran teachers, including a lot of retired teachers who just want to send notes of support, who have shared that they have reached out to their legislators based on some of what I've shared with them. Certainly to Senator Grassley and to Senator Ernst at the time of Ms. DeVos's nomination. So that's really the most heartening response. I would say legislatively, I've certainly heard positive things from our from Democratic legislators, some who have reached out and had some good conversations. I would say I've had very limited response. 2 years ago, I actually got quite a bit of response from Republican legislators who wanted to interact a little bit. And then that has seemed to slow down in the course of the last 2 years. So very little. I get from, say, Senator Grassley, I get the typical form letter that goes to everybody who sends a note on at the time on Betsy DeVos or an education issue. So I tend to get that. But in general, again, my peers have been very, very supportive. I teach in a district where my school board is very supportive, very, very thoughtful about these issues, who are themselves, in many cases, very strong advocates, are all very strong advocates for our public schools. So I'm very appreciative to teach in a district in a place where there is strong support and has been support for the role I've tried to take on as an advocate for teachers and for public education.
I think it's your most recent blog post was titled, "This Teacher is Becoming Maladjusted," which is an interesting title. So maybe that's one we can talk about in a little more
sure.
detail. What were you saying in that piece?
I went to a conference with a professor, Christopher Emden. He's an amazing speaker. Yeah, I got a chance to have lunch with him, and he's a hip-hop educator is what he's famous for. The title of my article in his speech that day was about becoming maladjusted to the status quo in many ways, and that's taken from a Martin Luther King speech in 1963, where he just described a number of things that he was not willing to become adjusted to. And my fear in education at the moment is that we will become adjusted to the idea that we don't need to fully fund, fully support, provide resources to our public schools in a time when we're looking at our state legislator and at the national level, vouchers, for instance, becoming prevalent. The kind of thing that there's no evidence that the vouchers or that more charter schools have had particular success in seeing increase in student achievement. What it does do is put money in the pockets of people who are out to privatize education and to turn a profit on education. And those of us who are in the field, that isn't our interest. It's certainly not the prevailing thoughts of those who are in education to provide more vouchers and go to more charter schools. So as well as just the simple sort of reduction in support for public education in general. In the article, I describe a variety of just thoughts on what I'm just not willing at this point to become adjusted to. Because I think over time in a 25 years in teaching, you know, there's any number of things that some of which were positive that you become adjusted to. But this current trend towards sort of an anti-public education sentiment that among many of our legislators, amongst many national officials, is just something that I don't think that we should allow ourselves to become adjusted to.
And do you see that trend as also contributing to even widening some of the achievement gaps and other gaps that exist in our schools between the haves and the have-nots, schools with high funding levels and the schools with lesser funding levels, or between schools with high populations of minoritized students versus those that don't have those populations? Do you see the current trends as contributing to exacerbating those differences?
I think that the research would back that up. I think in Iowa, the real issue is about rural versus urban or rural versus suburban. You know, the evidence would suggest that more charter schools and voucher systems would really have a detrimental effect in rural education, because any charter schools or schools that are going to profit off of new building are going to happen in high-density population areas. And it's going to, by the definition of them, pull resources away from rural schools. So in Iowa, I think that's the particular impact. In larger metropolitan areas, I think the evidence suggests that in some circumstances, they do provide an option, and sometimes those options show some short-term benefit. But the truth is that when you the primary research that exists would suggest that by simply providing more support to the public schools, that doors are open to all students, is where you really see the impact, where there's really going to be gain. Among the problems with charter schools is that they're not required to open their doors to students with special needs. They tend to not be high in opportunities for the arts, for related arts programs. They're really, in general, have tended to be meat and potato schools that focus on core subjects, and that enables them to potentially lift standardized test scores, in a short-term limited fashion. But at the end of the day, they do not end up enriching the whole of the student. And they certainly, there's evidence in the states that have enacted them, do not put out support for students with special needs and students who come with challenges, versus public schools who go to great efforts to support all students, to support students who have a variety of needs and a variety of issues, both economic and social, that I think is what makes public schools strong, but are not necessarily what make public schools show gains in, say, standardized testing.
Another of your blogs was really a letter to your son who is becoming a teacher or who wants to become a teacher. Could you just say a bit about what was the message in that blog post that you made?
It was very personal, obviously. I do have a son who's 18 years old and is a freshman. He really, in his heart, knows he wants to teach. He's had some great experiences with mentors. Already at 18 years old, he's had some phenomenal experiences. And what I wanted to say at that, because we're at a time when you're seeing the teaching jobs going unfilled, or the pool of candidates, the number of people going into teacher preparation programs is declining on the national level, and I believe stats would say it on the state level, so I wanted both to share an encouragement to him, to express to him that my experience over 25 years has been that teaching is incredibly rewarding, and to not allow the political climate to influence that the work that he wants to do and that he knows is right. And so that one got a lot of attention, obviously, from young teachers who just appreciated someone encouraging them. Because at the moment, I think, even amongst teachers, those of us who are veteran teachers, we are at times reluctant to encourage students to go into this profession because it's difficult work. It's at a time when the work is maybe not being respected in the way that it once was. Public schools are facing challenges they've never faced before. And sometimes it's hard for us to encourage young people to want to take on these challenges. And yet, knowing my son particularly, who is passionate about teaching, is passionate about the things he got from teachers, the things he received, the gifts that he received from the teachers who cared about him and worked with him, to encourage him to continue to kind of forge forward and to hold strongly to the things he believes are important, which in his case, as I was a music teacher, he's thinking of being a music teacher, the importance of that, the importance of all the experiences that just go outside of, you know, are we teaching kids to simply be standardized test takers? Because at the end of the day, a lot of the rhetoric around education is what's happening to test scores. And while that's important, that shows some measure of student achievement, at the end of the day, that's not what any of us got into teaching for. It's not what the public schools are meant to do. And so the narrative that's being told is, well, test scores are going down, so we need to create this change. And that's the wrong narrative. The narrative needs to be about what we're doing for every kid who walks in the door. And for a young teacher to come out, I want to empower him, empower young teachers to feel a sense that they have ownership of what they're doing, that they feel empowered to really make a difference in the lives of kids. And I hate to think that there's going to be a generation of young people, smart young people, who are going to resist going into public education because of the rhetoric that's happening currently in the political waters.
That was Pat Carney, an educator, blogger, and now an activist advocating for teachers, students, and public education in Iowa. Before we move on to our next guest, I want to remind our listeners that we are in the first week of KHOI's Spring Fun Drive. People may not know that often after a local talk show, someone will call the station or send a text to say that they thought a particular segment was interesting or touching. For some, it may be a driveway moment, or it made them laugh or surprise them. Or sometimes they contact us with a suggestion on how we could have improved the segment. And we listen to all of those comments, even the critiques, because we want to hear from our listeners, whether it's positive or not. So let us know what you think. And one way you can let us know that you're listening and what you think is by making a donation or becoming a member of KHOI. You can donate online at khoifm.org, or you can call on the phone 515-292-2878, or drop by the station at 410 Douglas and become a member or drop off your donation in person. The standard membership is $55 per year, but you can donate at any level or any amount. So let us know you're listening and that you support KHOI, now heading into the end of our fifth year of being on the air. But now I'm excited to welcome Amanda Pettifish-Schrag to Local Talk. Amanda is an assistant professor of theater at Iowa State University, and she's a puppeteer. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
I wish we could show the listeners some of your puppets. I've seen photos of them, but since we're on the radio, we can't do that. We'll have to kind of paint a picture,
yes,
with words in what you do with puppets. You just have such an interesting story of how you got interested in puppet. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, I had the great fortune of being born into a family of puppeteers. My mother and father had decided right kind of around the time that I was born that they were interested in exploring puppetry and sort of creating a small home-based business around puppets. And so from the time, there really hasn't been a time in my life that I haven't been around puppets. And I actually started working with them in terms of performing with puppets and eventually building and designing and writing scripts and learning how to manage the company. But all that started when I was about 4 years old. So I spent really much of my early life and then continued kind of on my own after getting through college, exploring this very unique mm-hmm. sort of subfield within the performing arts.
A family of puppeteers.
Yes. That's
just a story waiting to be told. But most people think of puppets as, you know, something fun or something for children. But you think of them kind of in a lot of different ways. And you think of them as a way to educate people and even for adults. So
absolutely. I think, you know, the history of puppetry is really so much about how this art form is really one that's accessible to the masses in a way that sometimes, especially historically, other performing arts maybe have not been. Within puppetry, you recognize that the way puppets can be built and the places that puppets can be used are really everywhere. So you don't, for example, have to be able to afford to rent a theater space to do puppetry. And you don't have to be able to have access to a great deal of very specific resources to build a puppet or to create a puppet story. And because of that, I think puppetry has really from its origins been geared to telling the stories of an individual community in a way that sometimes theater, because it requires access to certain resources, mm-hmm. has not been able to tell the stories of sort of the every person or the person who maybe doesn't have access to a lot of political clout or power. So we see puppetry being used a lot, not only to educate communities, but also to tell the stories that aren't being told within mm-hmm. a community. And I think that's such a powerful and compelling history for this art form.
Yeah, perspectives that maybe don't make their way into the more formal theater.
Right, right.
I never thought of it that way. Is there something about puppets that also makes them more effective in terms of bringing people in?
I certainly think there's something. There is a sort of magic to the transformation that occurs within a puppet performance, in that you know that these are objects. Mm-hmm. These are things that have no inherent life. And suddenly, because there's this human operator, we see this really fundamental transformation. And I think often what that allows the puppeteer to do is distill the moment into its most essential thing. We talk a lot in puppet training about the fact that a puppet is never going to be good at everything that a human being can do. So, for example, a lot of puppets are not going to be really well suited to making specific facial expressions. Mm-hmm. But sometimes when you have to distill, if we took an emotion like sadness, for example, what does sadness look like if I don't have full facial expression? Mm-hmm. And you start to discover that the tilt of the head or the way the chin dips down somehow becomes more able to provoke this potent form of the emotion than sometimes all of the things that we've come to commonly recognize and perhaps even dismiss because we think we know what that human being is going to do next. A puppet is, in its own way, a little bit inherently strange, so we pay closer attention and then we distill something down to its essence, and that can make for a really kind of powerful magic.
Could you give an example of when, in something you've done, you've used puppets to show that what you called an every person story?
Sure. Certainly when I was growing up, one of the things that I so admired and appreciated about the way my parents approached the craft is that I think because they were, and my mother is a teacher, and both my parents were really involved in their local communities, I think they felt a great sense of obligation and sort of calling to be sure that the stories they were telling were benefiting their audience. And I remember one particular story that we had been commissioned to to create a production of The Three Little Pigs and
a
to
classic.
Go out. A classic. And what I remember was so interesting is when my mom was working on The Wolf in particular, she started, I remember while she was working on it down in the workshop, that she started to sort of verbalize what she was thinking and her process and thinking about what's the wolf's perspective in this story, mm-hmm. which is, I mean, usually the wolf is the bad guy. And that can be fun. And there's nothing, I think, inherently wrong about that. But as she was crafting this puppet, she started to think about, well, why is this fundamental question of why is this wolf not with a pack? Because in the story, the wolf
is a lone wolf.
Yeah. And so in that process of questioning, as you're using these materials to create this thing that takes, of course, so much time and so much effort, I think this story of a wolf who had been separated from its pack and was really kind of out making mischief out of lack of knowing who he was and what he was supposed to be doing became this really fun, and it was a comedic story, but had this impactful message, mm-hmm. I think, about how important belonging is and how ultimately we all want to be part of something bigger. So it was this silly story that on the one level, everybody recognizes and everyone knows what it is. But because there were puppets involved, I think people were more willing to pay attention mm-hmm. to this sort of new direction that the story went.
That's a wonderful example. Yeah, thanks for sharing mm-hmm. that. And so from your descriptions, you're also letting us know that you make the puppets.
Yes.
So
yes.
Tell us a little bit about that. What kinds of materials do you use? What's that process?
Well, in most of my work, I primarily use, for lack of a better term, I use trash to build puppets. So I use materials that other people have discarded and have determined are not worth much. And then, so part of my job is not only, I think, figuring out how to build a puppet, but how to figure out how to make materials that are not being used for their intended purpose to work in the creation of that puppet. And part of what I think is really interesting and what I love about that work is that not only am I getting to take something that someone else has said is perhaps of very little value or no value and turn it into something that hopefully has a lot of value in its ability to tell a story. But I find when I work with these materials they're all around us. And puppeteers historically have often in their traditions been called to use materials that are indigenous to the immediate community, that are locally found or mm-hmm. somehow reflective of the culture. And for me, I think whether I like it or not, trash is reflective mm-hmm. of our culture. So if part of my job as a puppeteer is to tell the story of my community and to tell the story of the world that I'm in right now, trash has an interesting ability mm-hmm. to force me to think about how I'm interacting with the world and to bring up, I think, new stories as well, that the material is so influential in determining what should this puppet be and what is this material best suited to tell us, which is the same process if you're working with wood or cloth. It just happens that my medium happens to be old plastic bags and potato chip containers.
And recently you're particularly working with a lot of plastics. Is that right?
I am. Most of my recent building and the projects I'm working on are specifically connected to plastic. Plastic is everywhere. And I think this thought kind of started from being really concerned about the fact that plastic mm-hmm. is everywhere, and that plastic has become, I think, sort of this forgettable material, when of course it is with us forever. And part of what intrigues me about the work, I think, is, I mean, I'm very aware of it. Like when I build a puppet that's built entirely from plastic, there's a point where you become aware that the thing you're creating is going to outlast you for a really long time. That a puppet made entirely from discarded plastic, whether it retains all of the shape you're giving it, one could question. But the basic materials that you're grappling with in that moment will outlive you and your children's children, which changes the way you think about the character and the story and everything that kind of comes from that point of creation.
And I just want to tell the listener that the idea of a puppet made from plastic sounds, oh, it must be just crude or something, you know, something not terribly attractive or artistic. But the photos I've seen, and we're going to put one of them on our website with this audio, the puppets themselves are beautiful. And the puppets themselves are really works of art. Aside from the performance in which they're used, they're just beautiful.
Well, thank you. And that's, I think, part of what is in puppetry in general, I've always been fascinated by when you see puppeteers take this stuff that when you look at it in its individual form has very little meaning or very little aesthetic or functional immediacy, and they create something so specific and so focused and hopefully, I mean, not all puppets need to be beautiful. I certainly strive to make the work such that we know what it's made out of, but we also see that that process of transforming something that we would oftentimes, I think, rather look away from in the case of trash, that we try and hide it or we bury it or we burn it or we send it away, that it can have life beyond that and could actually have a really exciting life beyond if we're mindful of it and if we're specific about what we're using and how we use it.
All right. Before we have to wrap up this very interesting conversation, I want to ask you about two other things. So you recently had a play accepted in a festival in Milwaukee?
I'm one of two playwrights chosen for a residency at Renaissance Theater Works. And playwriting is something that I sort of entered through the puppetry world as well, because as part of my family's troupe, I learned how to adapt stories and how to write plays. But that is something I also do in my work. So I had a play called The Endurance of Light accepted, and I will get to spend some time this summer with them workshopping the play and having public readings of the play. And there's so many amazing playwrights out there. This particular company focuses on showcasing the work of women playwrights. So it's a particular honor, and I'm just thrilled to have been chosen.
Well, wonderful. For that. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. And the other thing I want to ask you about is The Tempest, which you're working
on
now. And so tell our listener to get their tickets for The Tempest.
Yes, The Tempest opens is an Iowa State University production and of Shakespeare's classic. And we open a week from yesterday. So we open on the 20th and run through the 23rd. And tickets are available now. You can go to the Stevens box office.
Okay.
And we would love to see everyone there for sort of – that's our last show of the season. So.
Okay. No puppets in it, but...
Well, we have a few shadow puppets that are in the production.
Wonderful.
So.
Well, this has been fascinating. What an interesting topic. I've been speaking with Amanda Pettifish-Schrog, an assistant professor of theater at Iowa State University and a puppeteer. So hopefully people in our community will have opportunities to see much of your work over the next few years.
Absolutely.
Thanks
so much for having me.
Before we sign off today, I want to remind our listeners once again that we're having our spring fundraising drive, and we have a special incentive for you this morning. You can receive a quality AM/FM weather radio free just by joining KHOI now and calling us on the phone. The first person today to call KHOI will receive this special gift. 515-292-2878. Become a member at any level, and you can receive this AM/FM weather radio as a thank you gift. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Thanks to our guests earlier in the show, Mary Rankin and Lynn Carey, talking about sustainability and the library, Pat Carney, an education blogger on Huffington Post and also a teacher from Iowa, and, of course, Amanda Pettifish-Schrag, a puppeteer and professor at ISU. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows on our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Thank you, Evan. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. KHOI is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from people like you, along with businesses and organizations. So please support KHOI. Easy to donate and become a member. Just go to the website and click on the donate button. Local Talk is also a radio production training workshop, which means that you can be part of our team of volunteer producers and reporters. If you would like to join the team, contact us at 515-292-2878 or through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.